WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Steve Earle's career was once described as a high-speed wreck with the carnage strewn down the highway. Earle's first album in 1986 made it to the top of the country music chart, but his career was derailed by heroin and crack habits. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Earle about his current comeback after rehab and a stint in jail. Also, humor writer Mark O'Donnell. His new novel is about identical twins. Mark O'Donnell's identical twin brother, Steve, is the former head writer of The David Letterman Show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Federal Election Commission is suing the Christian Coalition. The commission charges that the group, founded by evangelist Pat Robertson, violated federal election laws by promoting Republican candidates for president and Congress. The FEC alleges that several candidates received improper coalition help. They include former President Bush, North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms, Virginia Senate candidate Oliver North, and House Speaker Newt Gingrich. White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta is meeting today with members of Congress to discuss a new plan to combat terrorism. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Yesterday, President Clinton invited the bipartisan leadership of Congress to the White House for talks about additional law enforcement measures to track down terrorists. The president wants Congress to pass seven provisions, including several that lawmakers refused to put in this year's anti-terrorism bill. The president wants expanded powers to wiretap suspected terrorists and a requirement that manufacturers of black powder explosives mark their products with chemical taggants. The taggants would help authorities track the origins of bomb residue. Republican leaders wouldn't say whether they would drop their objections to the wiretaps or the taggants. The National Rifle Association is opposed to tagging explosives, and Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle says that issue will be difficult to resolve. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Defense Secretary William Perry is in Saudi Arabia. He's talking security and money matters. Perry wants to improve security for U.S. troops in the Saudi kingdom. He is also expected to talk to the Saudis about ways they can help pay for these changes. Former Atlanta Mayor Andrew Young is hailing it as a triumph of human spirit. Young helped reopen the city's Centennial Olympic Park today for the first time since Saturday's pipe bomb attack. The park echoed with the jazz trumpet sounds of Wynton Marsalis, gospel singing, and the cheers of some 3,000 people. Water burst once again from the five-ringed Olympic fountain. The bombing led to the deaths of two people and injured more than 100 others. Young said today their suffering was not in vain. The park was open at 8 o'clock this morning. NPR's Mark Schramm was there.
They only have a few entrances open. People are filing in one by one. They're not searching everyone. They're not putting everyone through metal detectors, but they are going to be searching bags at random. And there are a number of security people at each entrance. There are security people walking around the perimeter. The area is cordoned off with a six-foot-high fence that goes all the way around the park. That's been there since the beginning. The streets are blocked off. There are police barricades running all the way around.
NPR's Mark Schramm reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow was down more than 4 points at 5,430. This is NPR. Investigators are testing a key piece of wreckage from TWA Flight 800. They're looking for traces of explosives from a crumpled luggage bin that was part of the forward cargo hold of the downed jetliner. The container was one of 16 aboard the jumbo jet. It was pulled from the Atlantic Ocean yesterday. Investigators hope the testing will confirm the theory the plane was brought down by a bomb that separated the cockpit and first class section from the rest of the plane. Officials say injuries to the bodies of the victims support that theory, but they don't prove it. The government says labor costs rose 0.8% in the second quarter of this year. That's the same as in the first 3 months of the year. NPR's John Itzty reports.
The moderate rise in labor costs, as measured by the Employment Cost Index, provides no evidence of increasing inflation pressure that might prompt the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates. The bond market welcomed the news and sent long-term interest rates lower. The Employment Cost Index is the government's most comprehensive measure of labor costs. It includes changes in wages, salaries, and fringe benefits. During April, May, and June, wages and salaries rose 0.9%, while the cost of benefits rose 0.7%. For the 12 months ending June 30th, the Employment Cost Index rose just 2.9%. The wage and salary portion of the index rose 3.2%. That's the best gain for workers in 4 years. I'm John Itzty in Washington.
Resorts along the Pacific coast of Mexico are relieved. Weather forecasters say Hurricane Douglas is moving westerly, and that should keep it away from land for at least the next 24 hours. Hurricane Douglas is the former Hurricane Cesar. That was when it was in the Caribbean Ocean. Cesar attacked Colombia and Central America before crossing over to the Pacific Ocean. Cesar is blamed for 35 deaths and leaving thousands of people homeless, mostly in Nicaragua. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A recent string of drug-related deaths in the rock world has dramatized a problem that is very old. Many talented musicians use drugs and become victims of their habits. My guest Steve Earle is a singer-songwriter-guitarist who's making a comeback after kicking addictions to heroin and crack. He served 60 days in jail on possession charges in 1994. He began his comeback last year with his critically acclaimed album Train A-Coming. He wrote the song Ellis Unit 1 for the soundtrack of Dead Man Walking, and now he has a new album called I Feel All Right. His first album, the 1986 release Guitar Town, fit into the wave of country music's new traditionalism. It went to number one on the country charts and was later described in Newsweek as helping galvanize Nashville out of its post-urban cowboy cheeseball slump. Before we meet Steve Earle, here's one of his original songs from his new album, I Feel All Right. This is More Than I Can Do.
You told me that I gotta stop, but it's more than I can do. You're gonna call the cops, but I ain't gonna run, 'cause you're the only one. There ain't no way
On a casual listen, this might sound like a nice love song, but the lyrics are really about a man who's obsessively jealous and threatening. I asked Steve Earle what inspired the lyric.
The O.J. trial was raging when I wrote this song, and that's really where it came from, which is kind of weird. I worried about it a little bit. I feel like sometimes when I play it, there should be a "Don't try this at home" disclaimer in front of it or something, because I definitely don't approve of that type of behavior. But it definitely has that. You know, that is definitely where it's coming from. It is obsessive.
It's the malevolent side of obsessive love. What inspired the song?
It's another one that I don't. I mean, there's a lot of me in this record, but this record was written coming out of a period in my life that I just assume, you know, like all the names have been left out in order to protect the guilty, which is me. And there's not any one situation in that song. I don't guess, or I might be lying to you, and I might not, but I don't really feel like it's necessary to get that particular about it.
The liner notes of your new album have a little paragraph written by you called "Perspective." You write, "When I was locked up, I was getting ready to go off on this boy that stole my radio. My partner Paul asked me where I was going. I said to get my radio, and then to go to the hole for a little while. He looked at me like I look at my 13-year-old sometimes and said, 'No, you ain't. You're going to sit your little white ass down and do your little time, and then you're going to get out of here and make a nice record.' So I made two." And that's dated November of 1995. What's the story behind that paragraph?
Just about exactly what it says.
Who is Paul?
A friend of mine that I knew from the street, and I got into jail, and he was there. And he was one of a couple of people that I hung out with when I was locked up that I knew. Two of them I knew from the outside. One of them was a guy I met in there. But one of the safest ways to go in an institution is to belong to as small a clique as possible, because they'll put 50 men in one cell, and so when stuff happens, it happens a lot faster than the guards can do anything about it. So it's a really potentially volatile environment. If you belong to a big clique of people, you know, 10 guys, 20 guys, you can't control their actions, and they may do something, and because to make somebody else mad, and that person that they've irritated may not have access to them, and then may go off on you. In the recreation area or in the gym or someplace else where the situation's not so controlled. So I sort of stuck in. We had one little corner of this 50-man cell that we sort of stayed in, and except to go and take showers and stuff. And it was just people that I knew. And they did take care of me because I was very sick when I got to jail. I was withdrawing from methadone and cocaine, and I was extremely ill. And Paul got me. I had an upper bunk, and by the third or fourth day, I couldn't even get in my bunk by myself, and Paul helped me get up there, and he also made sure that I secured a bottom bunk when the upper bunk became totally unworkable. He'd been there for about a year and a half when I got there, and never had been to trial, and he's still there, as far as I know.
How long were you in this prison?
I was in 60 days. I was doing a year. I was doing 11 months and 29 days. After much begging and pleading from my lawyer and 30 days in treatment, they finally decided to probate the rest of my sentence.
Now, you grew up in San Antonio in a pretty middle-class family, right? Your father was an air traffic controller.
Yeah, I was very middle-class. We moved a lot. We were renters, so we lived all over the San Antonio area. I grew up, what I really call home is a town called Schertz that's right outside of San Antonio, and it's sort of been engulfed by San Antonio now, but it was about 30 miles outside the city limits when I was growing up there. Randolph Air Force Base is there. There's about 5 Air Force Bases in San Antonio, which are the major industry, no matter what anybody thinks.
You dropped out of high school in 1971, and really wanted to, you know, write songs and perform. You started hanging out with the songwriter Townes Van Zandt. Why him? What excited you about him? Or was he one of the few songwriters that you actually had access to?
Well, he was one of the few there were a lot of songwriters in Texas that I could have access to. Actually, it was a pretty damn good place to be a songwriter when I first started writing. I mean, there was There was Towns and Jerry Jeff and Steve Fromholz, and who I saw the other night for the first time in years. There was a lot going on in Austin, and of course, naturally, everybody was telling me, "Hey, this is a, it's, you know, you don't need to go to New York or L.A. or Nashville because we got, you know, the music business is coming to Austin. There's going to be, this is going to be the next music industry center." Even at 19 years old, I knew that that wasn't true. Austin's too, the weather's too good, the girls are too pretty, and the dope's too cheap, and you can't get anything done in a place like that. So I came to Nashville.
You were like the kid in the crowd. What was it like to be the kid?
Well, it was educational. When I got to Nashville in 1974, this place was like a university for songwriters because it was very democratic. It got down on any given night at somebody's house, either John Lomax's house or at Jim McGuire's photography studio. There was a bunch of people sitting around and several guitars going around the room, and a jug. You know, I mean, there was plenty of drinking and carrying on going on too. But we were nocturnal. We stayed up all night and we played our new songs for each other. And that stopped for a lot of reasons within a couple of years after I got here. But you could see anybody from like me and David Olney, who were at absolute street level, to Neil Young in the same room. And it was a great place to learn how to write songs.
Well, let's hear a song that you wrote that Travis Tritt recently had a hit of. And you recorded this on your next-to-last album, Steve Earle, Train A-Comin'. This is called Sometimes She Forgets. When did you write this? Yeah, go ahead.
It's an old song. It was written during the period when I was getting up and going to the office and writing songs every day. And I wrote what I thought were a lot of really commercial songs, and they told me that they were too country, so none of them ever got recorded until this one did last year.
Well, I like the song a lot. What do you think of it now?
I'm real proud of it. It's always been one of my favorite songs I've ever written. The songs that survived to make it on to Train A-Comin' were the older songs of mine that I seemed to always dust off when I went out and did a solo acoustic tour. That was the main criteria.
Oh, okay. Well, this is Steve Earle.
If you see her out tonight and she tells you it's just the lights that bring her here and not her loneliness, that's what she says, but sometimes she won't guess. If she tells you she don't need a man, she's had all the comfort she can stand. You'd best believe every word she says. But don't give up, 'cause sometimes she forgets.
Steve Earle from his previous record called Train A-Comin'. Now, you've said you first did heroin when you were 13. How did you do it? How did you get it?
Well, it's San Antonio, Texas, during the Vietnam War. It's 150 miles from the border, so there's a constant supply of real strong, real cheap brown heroin, and then the Vietnam War going on. So there was lots of dope, and it was very, very cheap. Dope was cheaper than alcohol in the city I grew up in.
Who turned you
much
on?
Much cheaper. It's a lot of people at school, my uncle, and who also gave me my first guitar, so that was sort of a mixed deal. But he finally ended up going to prison for selling heroin, and he got out, and he never did heroin again, but he's had a drinking problem for most of his life since then.
Did your father know?
My father, I don't think they knew the extent of my drug habit. My music always seemed to intervene enough. Like, I moved to Nashville and the heroin up here sucked, so I sort of stopped doing it, and it was until I got to where I could afford it and started traveling around other cities where there were better drugs, and I slowly drifted back into doing it again. When I stopped doing heroin, I replaced it with other drugs. But it, my parents, they were aware. It became an issue in around the house a few times. But You know, I was pretty good. I was an addict. Addicts are good at getting over. And you know, I managed to convince the psychiatrist I was sent to that I was cured, and he pronounced me cured, and that was the end of it as far as my family was concerned.
What shape were you in when your album Guitar Town came out in 1986, an album that made it to the top of the country charts?
Well, I was a functioning addict. I was probably the ultimate functioning heroin addict, but I was a heroin addict. I mean, at that point, I could lay down and get sick for 3 days and then go out on the road. It's just what happened is the same thing happened to me. It happens to all addicts. I got to the point that I couldn't get through, you know, the 3 days that it takes to detox anymore, and it required more drugs, and I needed them all the time, and it finally got to where it was a full-time job to get drugs, and I didn't even have a guitar anymore because there wasn't any time to play it.
Did you keep your habit hidden from people in the record company, or do you think that they knew?
They knew. I was nowhere near as good as hiding it as I should have been in retrospect. I was sort of, I think I thought I was invisible. And that got worse as my habit became worse. I think as long as I was performing, as I was making shows, which I did till the very, very last, as long as I was making shows and making records, there were people that just sort of turned their back on it. It made them uncomfortable, but they turned their back on it. There were other people that I think actually thought it was kind of cool, as long as it wasn't them. And you know, and I probably fed off that to a certain extent. It's just one of those deals. It's not that. It's really your tendency when you're in active addiction is to think that you're special. The way I looking back at it now, I was doing the same thing that all addicts do. It's called permission to use. And I didn't need a reason to take drugs. I was an addict. I could always tell you one if you asked me, but I didn't really need a reason. Just being an addict was reason enough.
Was there a big difference between the impact of crack and heroin on you and on your addiction?
Sure. I mean, there's people on the street that believe that crack cocaine was sent to finish the dope fiends off. I've never seen anything like it. They call it the product on the street. I mean, the professional drug dealers do. It gets everybody, too. I know lots of kids out there that I know, you know, that I bought drugs from that pride themselves on smoking a little pot, but they don't ever touch the product, you know. But then they start busting up rocks and putting it in a joint. And, you know, almost every kid I know that started out just selling, like, rock cocaine on the street, you know, ends up on the pipe eventually. And, you know, they'll sit there and tell you that that's not true, and they'll tell you that they're slicker than that. But it's I had a kid, the day I went to jail, I went and bought one more rock and ended up getting a pistol thrown up in my face by a kid that I'd known since he was 9 years old. And he knew me. He just had gotten to the point that he couldn't get anybody in front of me any dope anymore because he smoked it all up. And he ended up trying to rob me for money. I rolled his arm up in the window of my car, probably broke it, and which I don't feel great about. And then I drove 2 blocks away and bought a rock from somebody else.
My guest is Steve Earle. He has a new album called I Feel All Right. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Babcock singer and songwriter Steve Earle, he's making a comeback after kicking heroin and crack habits. At the periods when you were most addicted, were you able to perform? Were you able to write? Was there music in your head? I mean, had music remained a part of your world?
No, it got to the point where it wasn't at all. The last 2 years especially, I didn't. I hung out in South Nashville for a lot of reasons. It's where the drugs were, but I could have beeped people and they'd have bought me drugs. And one time I did it that way. I didn't have to hang out there. One of the reasons I hung out there is black people do not listen to my music, and so I was fairly anonymous there. And people just left me alone as long as I had money to pay for drugs. And it's not, I got to a point that it was a full-time job just to get up in the morning and get my hands on enough money to support my habit. Whether I had money or not, I still had to go get it, and I used it up at such a furious rate that I was always a little bit ahead of, you know, of my royalty checks. I didn't have to do some of the things other people have to do, but I would have. You know, there's no doubt in my mind, at the bottom had just fallen out, I couldn't get any more money, you know, I would have been stealing stuff to support my habit. It was just a matter of time.
So the habit just drove music out of your head?
It drove it out of my life. There wasn't any time. I didn't even have a guitar. You know, I'd traded them all for dope in the middle of the night or pawned them. And I lost a lot of nice guitars. But it really was, even if I'd had a guitar, I wouldn't have had time to play it. I woke up in the morning and I was on the trail from the time I woke up until I went to sleep, which was usually 3 or 4 days later.
Did the degradation aspect of it ever get to you, of being so enslaved to the habit and having lost something that was so special for you, your music?
Yeah, I mean, I know when I started to die, and that was when it got to the point that I couldn't write anymore. And I knew I was dying, but I just didn't think that there was anything that I could do about it.
Now, when you were in prison, you ended up in rehab during the prison stay. So you were addicted when you got into prison. Were you able to kick during that rehab stay?
Well, I went to a hospital. They finally realized that they didn't want to be responsible for me at age. I was 39, and I wasn't in the best physical condition. And my blood pressure got pretty high, which is a withdrawal symptom, and they decided they didn't want to be responsible for me being in the Metro jail anymore. So they got from my lawyer worked it out for me to go to into treatment. I was still an inmate, but I went to Lincoln Regional Hospital, which is down in Fayetteville, Tennessee, and I did my medical detox there, and that means that they basically give you medication to control your blood pressure and monitor you. And the food was a lot better there than it was in jail. It was just a matter of once I got there, I don't know what happened, but something, I guess the fog cleared because I actually had been physically restrained from taking drugs for several weeks, and that hadn't happened to me in years. I probably wouldn't have gotten clean if I hadn't gotten locked up. I know I wouldn't have. I would have just died.
After rehab, were you sent back to jail?
Yeah, which was hard because there is dope in jail, believe that. And
were there dealers inside who tried to get you high?
Not
again?
Dealers. There was a big drug roundup the weekend that I got back to jail. I got back in on a Saturday. And you're like, you know, that was just really depressing. And I thought I was going to get out. I thought they were going to let me go home after treatment, and it didn't work out. And I went back to jail, and there was a guy sleeping. The way I went back to the Blackwood jail, and that was like, you know, just double rows of bunks. There's four rows of bunk beds in one room. And you basically sort of sleep head to head so nobody's feet's in anybody's face, you know, is the idea of it. And I'm sleeping head to head with a guy that had gotten in and then somehow missed, you know, what was a minuscule amount of rock cocaine on the street, but was a gold mine in there. You know, he had one big, probably $30 or $40 rock, you know, a rock about an inch in diameter. And it, he just, that was going around, and I knew it was going around. And the only way I dealt with it was I just sort of pretended for the first time in my life that the rules weren't to be broken. And I just said, well, I'm in jail. There's not supposed to be dope here, so there isn't. And I went to every meeting that was available to me, which was about four a week, between NA meetings, AA meetings, CA. I went to any kind of AA. It didn't make any difference. And I just sort of kept to myself and just worked the best program that I could work in jail.
Steve Earle will be back with us in the second half of our show. Here's the title track of his new CD, I Feel All Right. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Now some of you would live through me, then lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. Huh. But I feel all right.
precious contraband and ancient tales from distant lands. Conquerors and concubines and conjurers from darker times.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Steve Earle, and we meet humorist Mark O'Donnell. His new novel is about identical twin brothers. O'Donnell's identical twin brother, Steve, is the former head writer of The David Letterman Show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with singer, songwriter, and guitarist Steve Earle. His first album, the 1986 release Guitar Town, went to the top of the country charts. In the 90s, his career was derailed by heroin and crack addictions. He spent 60 days in jail on possession charges in 94 and went through rehab. Last year, he started a comeback. Now he has a new album called I Feel All Right. During the height of his addiction, he gave up singing, writing, and even thinking about music. When did music start coming back into your head?
As soon as I got to Buffalo Valley, and in jail, there aren't any guitars.
Center.
Yeah, there aren't any guitars in jail. That's just in the movies. But in Buffalo Valley, I was allowed to have a guitar an hour a day. And I wrote Goodbye, which is on Train to Come. It was the first thing I'd written in 4 years. And I wrote Hardcore Troubadour, which is actually a melody that I'd started 3 or 4 years before, but I wrote all the lyrics and treatment.
Why don't we hear Hardcore Troubadour? It's the second track on your new CD.
Girl, don't bother me and lock your door. Sat there hollering, darling, don't you love me no more. You always let him in before, and I didn't you? He's just singing the same old song that he always sang before. He's the last of the Hardcore Troubadour. Just a somebody switch now, wouldn't you? He gonna make love on your satin sheets, wake up on your living room floor. He's the last of the Hardcore Troubadours. And now he's the last of the all night do right. Send the need to win the daylight. He's the last of the Hardcore Troubadours.
That's Steve Earle from his new CD, I Feel All Right. How do you think your voice changed after a long period of not singing and after a long period of doing drugs, which can be very hard on the voice? I mean, I think your voice sounds really great and really strong, and I'll confess I'm really surprised at how strong it sounds.
Well, my voice got a rest. One thing about sitting around, you know, like shooting dope, smoking crack for a few years, is I wasn't singing. And I really had gotten to the point that I toured so much. And heroin's very hard on your voice. Actively using and singing, heroin relaxes your vocal cords. You could always tell when I was high because my voice would drop about an octave. And you go out and try to sing, you try to bring, you try to hit high notes and bring your vocal cords up to tension, and there's a certain amount of thickening that happens. And that had happened to me. Plus, I had a traumatic injury to my vocal cords. I was arrested for assaulting a police officer in Dallas. I assaulted his nightstick with my neck is what I did, and it just got into a big thing. They tried to send me to the penitentiary for that, and that was one situation where I was absolutely innocent. But one of my vocal cords bled really badly. So there's a big difference between my voice if you listen to like Exit Zero and Copperhead Road. It became a lot gravel. There's a lot more gravel in it from that point on, and that's still there. But I got a rest, and I think I'm singing the best on this record. And these are all track vocals on this record. Every vocal on "I Feel Alright" is the straight track, you know, vocal performance. There aren't any overdubs on it.
I've spoken to some performers who are really surprised at what it feels like to perform when they're straight because they'd never really experienced it before.
Yeah.
Is that the position you're in? Is it a different experience to perform straight?
No, it's basically that. I mean, I didn't think that I went out and performed. I would have told you that I'd never performed when I was high, but I obviously had to at the end because if I hadn't been high, I would have been sick. Mm-hmm. And I performed sick a lot, you know, that ended up happening, drug dealers aren't necessarily dependable people. I think I'm a better performer than I've ever been. I'm definitely a better writer than I've ever been. I'm really, really proud of this record. The band right now, is smoking. This whole tour has been a lot of fun, and I was very relieved to find out that I genuinely enjoy my job, because it had gotten sort of miserable for me, because everything's miserable for a junkie. Mm-hmm. You get to the point, it's really nice to go out on the road and not wake up sick in the morning and not have to worry about where I'm going to get dope in a town I've never been to before. And it's put a lot of the fun back in it for me. And so I'm back to some sort of midlife crisis that's taking place in a bus, but I'm really, really enjoying being out there.
What's the midlife crisis about?
Well, it's just, you know, I'm 41 years old, and I actually am probably more roadworthy than I was when I was 31.
But you don't want to be on the road that much, or?
No, I love being on the road. That's the whole point. I feel like maybe I'm not supposed to.
Oh, I see.
Like it as much as I do now. It's not a, you know, it's like it's buses are rolling locker rooms. It really gets to you after a while. It's a bunch of people living at fairly close quarters. We had our air conditioner break down in the bus one time in '87. We were going across the desert, and we made a little videotape we called Das Bus because it got down to everybody sitting around in their underwear playing cards, you know, and because the air conditioning did not work. And in 1990, which was the last full-blown tour that I did, I was thinking at the end of it, boy, I guess I'm just burnt out and I'm tired of doing this. And the truth of the matter, all I was tired of was trying to deal with my drug habit and perform. I'm having more fun making records than I ever have, and more fun than I've had touring in a long, long time.
I've been choosing all the records so far. Let me ask you to choose a favorite track from your new CD.
Oh, let's see. What have we not gotten to? Probably Valentine's Day. I'm real proud of that track. I'm real proud of the melodies on this record.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, my lyrics, I mean, not that I'm not proud of the lyrics on this record. I think I'm writing lyrics as well as I ever did. But that was always my strong suit, and I think I got into more varied kinds of melodies. And Valentine's Day, I mean, surprises a lot of people, you know, coming from me.
Now, did writing this song come easy to you?
I wrote this song with a little bit of a gun to my head. It was just basically Valentine's Day, and I didn't have I'd forgotten, and I don't drive because I can't get no kind of license. And I realized it was Valentine's Day was coming up, so I basically wrote it as a Valentine's card, and so it was written in sheer desperation. It was.
That's was it well received?
yes, at the time.
Well, I like the song a lot. I'm glad you chose it. This is Valentine's Day from Steve Earle's new CD, I Feel All Right.
I come to you with empty hands. I guess I just forgot again. I only got my love to send on Valentine's Day. I ain't got a card to sign. Roses have been hard to find. I only hope that you'll be mine on Valentine's Day. I knew that I swore that I wouldn't forget. I wrote it all down. I lost it, I guess. There's so much I wanna say, but all the words just slip away. The way you love me every day is Valentine's Day.
Steve Earle's new album is called I Feel All Right. He's featured on an MTV program called To Hell and Back, a special taped at the Cold Creek Correctional Facility outside of Memphis. It premieres on MTV the weekend of August 17th. Coming up, humorist Mark O'Donnell. This is Fresh Air. Humorist Mark O'Donnell has written a novel called Getting Over Homer that was described in The New Yorker as entrancing and hilarious. It's about a man in his early 30s who's come from Cleveland to New York to try to make it as a songwriter. He's a romantic looking for true love, but he has a talent for falling in love with the wrong men. The novel also follows the main character's relationship with his twin brother, an actor who co-stars in a popular sitcom. Author Mark O'Donnell has an identical twin brother, Steve O'Donnell, who's former head writer for David Letterman's show and author of a book of Letterman top 10 lists. Here's Mark O'Donnell reading from the beginning of Getting Over Homer, in which the character is wondering if he cares more about falling in love than other people do.
What I still haven't figured out in the great greenish-gray scheme of things is whether I've had more communion or less than other people. I'm not talking about that limp plaster poker chip Sister Scholastica used to tell us would drip blood if we received it insincerely at Mass. I mean that fourth-dimensional feeling of being with other people happily. I don't want to pity myself, but if in fact I have had a lonely life, I think I should be told. On the other hand, maybe I'm a lucky bum, with all the sweet skirmishes and sibling solidarity I've had, and my song that people still whistle, and I just aim too high at inexpecting sublimity to be constant. Maybe I've done really well, and greed makes me pretend to act dissatisfied, as if acting deprived could get me extra portions. I'm a victim of song lyrics there, and TV commercials, and pornography. They all act like fulfillment is just a doorbell away. Or worse, they eat theirs in front of you, and with TV or porno, you're by definition left out. As I said, it all boils down to that desire to commune. First of all, I am a twin. Communion points there. People have always assumed there's magical telepathy and closeness involved, and I've always treasured their envy. I figure, Envy's the best measure of anything's worth.
Mark O'Donnell, thanks for reading from your new book, Getting Over Homer. Now, let's start with the fact that you are a twin. Your twin is...
Steve O'Donnell.
Who writes...
Well, he was Dave Letterman's head writer for many, many years. He's written a Seinfeld episode. He's an Emmy winner. I'm quelling.
And he's done a lot of the 10 best lists for Letterman.
Yes, that's right. That's right. He's been on the bestseller list.
So, do people assume that because you and your brother Steve O'Donnell are twins that there is a magical telepathy between the two of you, and is there one?
Yeah. Well, if not magical, I think it's really, it's close, though. If he's feeling lousy, I can't feel good, and his joy is a source of joy for me. But I think that would be true of best friends or siblings or spouses, and that was something I wanted to exploit in the book, which is about how people, you know, relate and love each other. Being a twin was too cool not to exploit at some point.
Yes, but you say you can't feel good if he's feeling bad, but the character in your new book who only feels good knowing that other people don't feel good either.
Well, he
it's
has...
the only thing that gives him comfort.
Yes, that's the secret hope that others aren't as happy as they seem to be. I'd like to think he's better than that, but in his weakest moments, he'd like to think that he's not the only one whose life is not relentlessly joyful. That's true. But he's from a big family, and I think by the end of the book, I'd like to suggest that he's actually had more happy communion with his family and friends and occasional sweethearts than unhappiness, that life is better than not.
How connected do you still feel to your twin brother? You don't work together, you don't live together like you did when you were kids.
Yeah, it's cool. Again, the image I like to use is like we were aliens who crash-landed on Earth and we're sort of constantly gathering data and then trading it. One of the coolest things, besides having a friend you can talk about your childhood toys with, is the fact that life is a mysterious adventure and we're constantly analyzing it. A best friend who shares virtually all the information in your brain, that has been rich.
Do you have a similar sense of humor? He's a humor writer, you're
a humor writer.
I think so.
When we visit friends and make fun of the objects they have on their mantle,
yes.
If we do it separately, people will say, oh, Stephen made the same joke. In all the dramas I've seen about twins, they tend to be actually the divided self, you know, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, one is good and one is evil.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what I wanted to explore in this book is where the twins are two versions of one thing, but they get weather-beaten and, you know, they're different just from experience. So that's the part of twinliness I never saw covered in literature before.
Now, do you feel envious of each other's success? I mean, when he started doing this, you know, high-paid, I'm sure, high-visibility work on TV, did you get some twinges knowing that you were writing short stories that weren't being as well-read as Letterman was being watched?
Oh, yeah. I covet the exposure, but it's just like if he's curing patients, a doctor has to wish another doctor success. If comedy is medicine, you've got to be happy when the right people are practicing it. I think he's very, very funny, and I think I'm funny. But we delight in each other's humor, and I'd love a wider audience, but I wouldn't wish him poverty. That wouldn't help me any. In fact, his security helps me.
Good. How would you compare your novel, Getting Over Homer, with the novels about love and romance that you've read over the years?
Well, the protagonist is gay, but I was trying to write a sort of, you know, continuous story like David Copperfield, where there's a huge cast of characters and everyone's trying to get on in life. David Copperfield, I guess, would be a model, or Lolita, where Humbert is crazily in love with the wrong person. That would be my model if the novel could be funny and beautiful, sort of absurd at the same time that it might touch heartstrings. That would be my goal.
Homer is the first lover who leaves the main character in your novel. What kind of relationship does Homer represent to you?
Well, I think it's sort of the, this is supposed to be like a hilarious Death in Venice, where the narrator, Blue Monahan, is poor and struggling. He's idealistic, and then he meets this dazzlingly smart, successful, good-looking guy who submits himself totally to the narrator, and it just seems so perfect that it's like a mirage that is bound to explode. And I think everybody, whether it's in their teenage years or in their midlife crisis, everyone's going to have some kind of illusion of happiness or heavenliness that in a world where, you know, you stub your toes and it rains, it just cannot be maintained.
Mark O'Donnell is my guest. His new comic novel is called Getting Over Homer. I like the observation in the opening of your novel, which you read for us, in which the character observes that song lyrics, TV commercials, and pornography all make you feel like fulfillment is just a doorbell away, but they also make you feel really left out.
Uh-huh. Well, again, I think we're all tantalized by the idea of that we all, it seems as if you're watching a TV commercial, we should all be ecstatically happy all the time. And that's a bit much to expect. So that's where the thing about people aren't quite that happy becomes a bit of a consolation. It's you're not the only one who's not in heaven all the time.
Do you ever find yourself getting surprisingly emotionally overcome by really stupid commercials or dumb song lyrics?
I have wept at commercials if they're cannily enough made, and to my surprise, an old rerun of Leave It to Beaver brought me to tears a couple weeks ago. If it's well done, it's people can manipulate those montages of, you know, family reunions and things.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly ring a lot of bells. But again, since I love to be moved, I cry at the movies and at the theater more than I do in life, because I guess I want to get my money's worth.
The character in your novel is a lyricist. Did you ever write lyrics?
I did. I've written hundreds of songs. I'm trying to think what's for Saturday Night Live. I used to write funny songs, and I have one published musical, which is called Tots in Tinseltown, a spoof of those old sort of Ruby Keeler pictures where a bunch of innocent kids go to Hollywood and get corrupted.
Oh, boy. Sing one of the songs for us.
Let me think. I might think you're witty and wise, or say you have beautiful eyes, but darling, you must realize I've always been easy to please.
That's good.
Well, it's supposed to mock the love song genre by being someone with low standards.
Right. No, that's very funny. My guest is humorist Mark O'Donnell, author of the new novel Getting Over Homer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with humorist Mark O'Donnell. His new novel is called Getting Over Homer. The main character in the novel has an identical twin brother. Now, I want to get back to your twin, to the fact that you are a twin, and your twin, Steve O'Donnell, was a longtime head writer for the Letterman show. Not still with Letterman, yes?
They're still friendly, but he's not on the staff.
Okay.
He may go in there to do some free Xeroxing.
Now, did you and your twin brother ever do things that shocked each other? And for example, what was his reaction when he found out that you were gay?
Well, I was shocked to discover that myself.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's an adolescent crisis. You work it out, and then everyone works it out at about the same pace. I probably accepted myself around the same time he did. But he was nicely judgmental. This is, you know, the mid to late 70s when it was still kind of forbidden and bizarre. Things are simpler for the coming out process now, I think, 15, 20 years down the line. But he was always supportive. And again, it was never, I don't think it ever called into question my decency or my desire to do the right thing. It was just the idea that, well, it's, you know, like cafeteria style, you make your own sundae.
But I'm wondering if it ever caused your brother to question his own straightness, if he thought, oh, well, what does that say about him?
Oh, well, I don't think so. But I think he suspected I was a closet heterosexual for a while, that I just wasn't trying. But again, I tried everything. But you finally, you know, and this is probably true of heterosexuality, too. You try a lot of stuff and then finally find what works for you.
Is your brother an identical twin?
We are identical, but after about 40 years, we've been weather-beaten in rather different ways. So the genes are the same, but we look different if you stand us up next to each other. But until our late 20s, early 30s, we looked a great deal alike, and we're mistaken for each other all the time.
That's interesting. So you look less and less like each other as time goes by.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. And that's just the effect of different experience, I guess, nature versus nurture.
Uh-huh. So what was it like when you were younger to look at somebody who looked like a carbon copy of you but wasn't and behaved differently?
Well, you know what? I'm not sure I've had the twin experience because I'm inside my body. I never saw the two of us together. Our friends have had the twin experience because they have seen us. But I didn't think of him as being a carbon copy of myself because, you know, our sense of self is nebulous or different. He was always very much an individual. But occasionally, like when you go to get a suit tailored in a three-way mirror, I'll catch my face at an angle that I never see it when I'm shaving, and I'll go, oh, Steve. So even I sometimes mistake myself for him.
Hmm. Seriously?
Well, as I say, as we grow more different. But it's that kind of thing. We have some childhood photos of the two of us, like, romping in the pool, and you don't know which one's which.
What were the distinguishing features that people, like our parents, for instance, could use to tell you and your brother apart?
Well, we had a system. We were doing some daredevil tricks on a tricycle when we were about 4 or 5 years old, and after an accident in the driveway, he had a little scar on his chin. So people used to say S for scar, S for Steven.
A little mnemonic device.
Yes, exactly, a mnemonic device. Also, I'm left-handed, he's right-handed. And then just to set, since I'm the poet, maybe I had a more baleful look and he was a little more rough and tumble.
The main character in Getting Over Homer figures out that when he was younger, he intentionally decided to be the most wholesome kid there ever was. And I think this is a defense in part to realizing that he's gay and he wants people to he just wants to have the image of being more wholesome than anybody else to counteract his own ambivalence about this discovery. And he says, wholesomeness was my fetish, a golden smokescreen. Ultimately, I was student council president. Did you go through this yourself of trying to be the
most wholesome
person?
I did, of being
a
very good kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's a syndrome, but I think it's identifiable human behavior. And also, it was just my urge. I liked being helpful. It's fun to get things done, and I thought I was capable of doing it. So I know leadership is always a combination of ego and virtue. When you look at political candidates, you wonder, are they candidates because they're selfish or because they're generous? You never know.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever audition for the same job as your twin brother, who's also a humor writer?
No. It's interesting. I've never thought about that. We never seem to have exactly the same ambition at the same time. Conveniently, right? We have different love objects. That would have been something if we were slugging each other over the same dame. But Saturday Night Live was, you know, a convenient way to stay alive and have fun. Letterman, Stephen had a great affinity for Letterman, and they are, you know, siblings of sorts mentally. And that was he was there from the very early days before Letterman was, you know, a real phenomenon. He just, it appealed to him, and he has a gift. Both of us, I think, one-liners are kind of our, you know, that's what we whittle best. And I think he was lucky that he and Letterman hooked up, because it's not something he could have aspired to do since he was a kid, since who knew from Letterman?
Right.
In the 1960s.
Weren't you smitten by television?
It's as an adventure, but not as a career. I would love to, you know, if only poetry and theater had the audience that television does. But certainly, and the television now is actually in a kind of golden age. What with Seinfeld and Frasier and The Simpsons, there's more, certainly I find more things funny on television than I find at the movies or in the theater. Not enough funny theater. But TV seems like a natural place to be funny.
Why do you think television is often funnier than theater or movies now?
Well, I think the theater is so underpaying and cruel that smart people who are funny are going to gravitate to television because they can make a living and ply their wit. In the movies, it's also crash and boom and special effects. I don't think the executives are willing to risk their investment on mere funniness, which is a shame. TV has a smaller budget, pays a lot more than theater, but in some ways less than the movies, so it's in the perfect middle ground, the way Earth was not too close to the sun and not too far away. TV is can breed comedy life.
Do you want to get back on TV?
Well, you know, I like the joke that I've made more money as a failure in Hollywood than as a success in literature, because I've written lots of stuff for TV that doesn't get made. You know, I've written a cartoon for Disney that I delight in, I think is hilarious, but I have no reason to hope they'll ever make it.
Right. Well, Mark O'Donnell, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, again, thank you for, as I say, letting me into your Rathskeller.
Mark O'Donnell's new novel is called Getting Over Homer. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan, too, directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
As terrorism becomes more of a reality in the United States, the scope of the U.S. Justice Department is expanding to include international threats. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Washington Post investigative reporter Jim McGee, co-author of a new book about the Justice Department and its expanding powers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.